recording. Oh shit, we're being quiet, sorry.
Oh my god, you told me to be quiet.
I forgot about being quiet. Okay.
Hi, I'm Raz Shaw and I'm a theatre director and lately a bit of a writer. And I've been very close to it three times.
And I'm Hannah Harris, and I'm a doctor, and sadly, I see a lot of it in my job.
In this podcast, we're going to be talking about the elephant in all our rooms.
Death.
Each week, we're going to be speaking to guests we admire and asking them, amongst other things, to curate their own memorial service.
In order to peel back the layers of their life so far.
First thing, practically, I did when I got the job on Coronation Street all those years ago was to buy headstones and get them engraved as a surprise for my dad. Happy birthday!
What they do or don't hold dear.
The small kindnesses that people are doing and the newfound appreciation of key workers, the care workers and the bin collectors, you know, the people that we, our society wouldn't survive without.
Their take on their own mortality.
And how they want to be remembered at the end of their lives.
I've always said that my obituary picture will be me in that bloody red anorak and wig with my pineapple juice in raw. It's no matter what I achieve.
A kind of desert island death, if you like.
Well, that's good. So, welcome to our brand spanking new podcast, Death and the Elephant. Our very special guest today is my friend.
And now my Julie. Friend.
Yeah, and now Hannah's friend. And also the CEO of my working life, the inimitable Julie Hesmetalsch.
Julie's best known for playing Hayley Cropper in Coronation Street, a role she played for 16 years. Since leaving in 2014, she's worked constantly on stage and screen, including in a play called Wit at the Royal Exchange in Manchester in 2016, which was directed by Raz here, and for which she won Best Actress at the Manchester Theatre Awards.
Hi, Raz here. Yes, well, I can't believe that was 5 years ago. That's what that's thrown me. On TV, her work includes Happy Valley, The A Word, Doctor Who, Cucumber, both written by the mighty Russell T Davies, and Broadchurch, for which she was nominated, quite rightly, for a BAFTA. Oh, and listen out at the end of this podcast for a brilliant cameo from Julie's oldest daughter, Martha. So, without further ado, let's get to it. Let's get to her. The great, the wonderful, here she is.
Julie Hez.
Julie Hez. Go.
Julie, thank you so much for being a guest on our podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. I've been reading your brilliant book, which for our listeners is a working diary that you wrote over the course of a year, starting in November 2016. I absolutely love it. I think everyone should read it. It's so inspiring. You're so busy and your life is so rich and you write with such openness and honesty. But it makes me want to talk to you about loads of things. I've got a whole list. Our theatrical daughters, your playwriting husband, your activism and the ton of theatre you create around that, the artist's way, telling the stories and hearing the voices of the marginalised and underrepresented, jealousy, creativity and trying not to worry about what other people think, Manchester, Corrie, gender, race. The list could go on and on.
It's a 17-hour podcast.
But we're not actually here to talk about any of that today, are we?
No, we're here to talk about death. Thank God, the relief of having to talk about death and not Corrie.
Before we do talk about death, I want to talk about another elephant in the room, which is Raz.
What? That's a really big elephant. I have actually put on weight over the pandemic, so that's a massive elephant.
You've worked together a lot in the last few years and you've developed a really strong friendship and a working relationship that you might describe as sparky, to put it mildly. Julie, you once wrote, "The foundations of our friendship are based on a healthy mutual disrespect and a sometimes brutal honesty." and your lovely husband, Ian Kershaw, known as Kersh, in the introduction to The Greatest Play in the History of the World, which is a one-woman play that he wrote for you and Raz directed. Uh-huh. In the introduction, Kersh wrote, "The stage directions listed here evolved through Raz and Julie's hard work, determination, and their mutual resentment." So, in preparation for today, I've taken a mediation course, I've done a hostage negotiation course, I'm wearing a hard hat, I'm waiting for the fireworks to fly, and I would love you to tell us a bit about this relationship between the two of you, how it all started and what it's all about.
Well, it's very funny, actually, because Raz sought me out to be the lead in a play that he was desperate to direct and had to pretty much court me for a little while. And I look back on those days with great fondness and no small amount of humour, because he presented a very different Raz to the one that I've come to know and love. No. So yeah, he came to Manchester and took me for lunch and was like, "I really want you to play this role." And the play that he wanted me to do by Margaret Edson was a play about death. And it was a play about an American academic dying of ovarian cancer. And for some reason, he'd got it into his head that I was the person to play that role. Even though it was a million miles from the way that I actually saw myself. And it was very interesting, actually, the to-ing and fro-ing that we went through over the couple of years before we actually got into the rehearsal room to do the play, with me absolutely determined not to do it at times and him absolutely determined that I would. And it was his dogged sort of pursuit of me to play this part, which was the basis that our friendship has grown on. And as soon as we got into the rehearsal room, we realised that our way of working was absolutely inspired by this mutual disrespect. And the fact that we can be absolutely honest with each other and tell each other when we're pissing each other off and when we're having a stupid idea is, I think, has created a really, really healthy working relationship that for me has become quite hard to follow. So when I work with other directors now, I have to curb myself a little bit. I feel like I have to sort of give a slightly softened version. I cannot talk to other people in the way that I talk to Raz. I can't talk to other people in the way I talk to Raz. I've got to sort of get out of that habit. So, but it's a very...
Yeah, I imagine you might slip into that in the rehearsal room.
Yeah, yeah, like getting notes. Oh, that's just stupid.
Yeah, yeah, well, exactly. So if I give Du a note she doesn't like, she'll just say no, that doesn't work. But I think one of the reasons it works is because actually in sort of a yin and yang way, I think if we've learnt that if Du is adamant about something, she's probably right. If I'm adamant about something, I'm probably right. And we fight about the grey area. And I think that's where the interesting stuff happen.
Yeah, yeah. You know, we really do trust each other, and it's like, and I think that is a key element that's often missing in good creative collaborations and partnerships. If you don't feel that you can trust the person who's kind of holding, you know, that performance together in the context of a production, you know, it's really, really hard. And so weirdly, even though that, you know, we don't really have these profound conversations about stuff, you know, like Raz has his kind of like take on death that you hear him, you know, bring out his party piece now, you know, and it's kind of sometimes hard to get past that. So what he really thinks about things, you know, it's kind of like he has his little set pieces. Well, yeah, that I think you protect yourself with those things, you know. So this idea always from you, Raz, is that I am not afraid of dying. I am not afraid of death. I face it head on. It's not the elephants in my room. And I think that in itself is your little security blanket against getting deeper into that stuff. And, you know, and part of our relationship is kind of really, really knowing that stuff about each other, actually.
Hours of therapy, but yeah, I think that's sort of true. And actually my therapist said that it's not true that you're not afraid of dying. You are afraid of dying because you don't want the pain and all that comes with it of dying, but you're not afraid of being dead, which is a sort of slightly different take on it. But also I do think that when the last time I almost died, which was in January 2020, before the pandemic, when I was in critical, I did sit there thinking, and sort of where this podcast came from, really, God, what have I done in my life? And I don't know if that's fear or whatever that is, but that is definitely what the being close to death brings out in me. But anyway, we're not here to talk about me. We're here to talk about you.
I find it really, really interesting, though, because I think that this podcast and in talking about death, you're talking a lot about legacy. I don't think any of us are immune to that, about thinking about what we're leaving. And, you know, and there's a beautiful Emerson quote that I've actually got on a mug, which is like pretty crass. But it's this beautiful thing about, you know, to have succeeded and what that is. And it's to have left something. And it says something like, be it by a healthy child or a garden patch, you know, to gain the respect of people and, you know, just little achievements that you can make in your life that actually add up to huge things. And there's a beautiful piece at the end of Middlemarch, George Eliot's Middlemarch, that my sister-in-law read at my dad's funeral, which is about, you know, there are some people that are the river, you know, the river going into the sea, and their legacy is very clear, you know. So there are people in all our lives and in the wider culture that we know that, you know, their legacy will live on. Someone like Nelson Mandela, you know, that's a perfect example, you know. Long, long, long after he's gone, people will know his name and know what he stood for and what he achieved in his lifetime. But actually, you know, behind him, there are all these tributaries. And there are all these people doing little actions and little kindnesses that actually add up to much, much more, you know. So, and I think that the pandemic has brought that into sharp relief in a lot of ways, you know, because actually people, the small kindnesses that people are doing and the newfound appreciation of key workers, the care workers and the bin collectors, you know, the people that totally. Our society wouldn't survive without. And they might not leave a massive legacy.
Yeah, but we desperately need them
all. Absolutely. So I've shifted my idea of legacy during this pandemic, I think. You know, our communities come together and just change things, you know, incrementally, but, you know, that shift things really in a big way.
Yeah.
I mean, that's sure, great. That's... It does ruin the end of the last four questions of our podcast, but apart from that, that's fine. We'll still go there.
I'm interested, you know, because I listen to your podcast with Ish, who's a doctor and an actor. And, you know, and obviously everything in his upbringing was just like pushing him towards medicine in that way that in some medical families it is. What was it for you? Mm. You know, what brought you to the position of being a doctor? Was it a similar thing?
Ooh, that's a good question, actually. So I didn't go to medical school till I was 32. Basically, I had a very tempestuous relationship with my dad when I was a teenager. He was from a working class background in South Wales. His dad was a miner and he went to grammar school and then ended up becoming a vet. And he really wanted me to be a doctor or a lawyer, basically. And so I was like, absolutely not. I'm going to do music. In the end, actually, my dad died. But when he was ill, I sort of came back to medicine and I'd kind of thought about it and had always thought I actually wouldn't be able to deal with death on a day-to-day basis was one of my big things.
That's quite a big thing for a doctor.
Yeah, but something you do have to deal with. And I do actually find very hard, which is part of the reason for making this podcast. But yeah, also I thought, you know, I wasn't clever enough, had quite a lot of kind of imposter syndrome about it. And, but yeah, I just kept coming back to it because I was so interested in medicine, you know, the science side of it, as well as the people side and the communications and how you're, you know, it's such a privilege. And so eventually I went for it and applied to medical school. My daughter was 7 and I was a single parent, actually. And yeah, and applied and moved down to London from Birmingham with my daughter, set up a new life here, went to medical school and graduated when I was 36. It was like a graduate entry medical course and have been working as a doctor since then. So yeah, finally did what my dad wanted me to do.
That's extraordinary. But in a way, it's the absolute opposite of Ishi's story of him sort of like going down that path because his family wanted him to and then going into performance. And
yeah, it's the other way. And now I'm really trying to find a balance of like both things, you know, doing something artistic and creative and alongside medicine?
Well, I think that's absolutely key, isn't it? I think that absolutely is the key to having a healthy life, is just being able to find the things that you're passionate about and find the place where you can coexist within those things.
And I think things have really changed in that regard. Our parents really felt like you chose what you did and then that's what you did and it was a job for life, whereas these days people are allowed to experiment and move around a lot between different careers and different jobs. And I think we should all kind of exploit that. Yeah. And encourage children to do so as well. Education can be so narrow and it doesn't have to be.
Absolutely.
Let's move on to the first elephant question, which is, it's kind of related to what you were saying last, Julie, about how your attitude to life and death have changed during the pandemic. What I've been wondering is, how has your mental health been in recent months? And what do you do to kind of manage it and maintain it? I know a lot of us have been struggling. A lot of young people have been struggling. You seem like such a positive, energetic person who operates at a very kind of high energy level a lot of the time. But I wonder, you know, whether there is a flip side to that. And if there is, you know, what do you do to maintain your mental health and look after yourself? I'm sure we could all learn from that.
Well, I suppose I work really hard at my mental health, actually, you know, and when I say that, I speak from a position of huge privilege in that I live a comfortable life. I have enough money to live on. I have a partner who is absolutely brilliant and who we completely share the load of like housework and child rearing together, you know, so I have it a lot. I'm able to go out, you know, and walk and run and do those things, you know, that are so helpful in terms of keeping you. So I have to, you know, put it in the context of that. But even within that, I feel like I do work hard. And I think the thing that I have kind of really, really started to be interested in is a sort of Buddhism. And I say sort of Buddhism because I'm certainly not in any way on my way to becoming a Buddhist nun. You know, there's this Buddhist writer that I love called Pema Chodron, but it's like Buddhism for beginners, you know. And a lot of it is just like breathing in all the hard stuff. So if you have a feeling that's really, really difficult and frightening, if you're anxious about something, rather than try and push that away and try and think positive, quite the opposite of that, you breathe it in and you try and you place it in your body and you go, right, what is this and where is it from? And that stuff, as she says, is what gives you your juice. You know, that's what gives you your richness as a human being. And it also gives you your vulnerability and your ability to empathize with other people. Because if we're just spending all our time trying to get it right and trying to push down those like sometimes absolutely incomprehensible negative feelings and doubts and fears that we can have, then, you know, we're never gonna get down to the actual brass tacks of, you know, who we are as people. And that to me is what being alive's about. It really, really is trying to understand human beings better, starting from myself and other people, and trying to see the connections between us rather than the differences all the time. And once you can get into that space, it can on paper seem really negative, you know, but it actually is about just like, no, this is where the richness, this is where the juice comes from.
So let's get back to death. So when when thinking about this podcast with you, Ju, I realized that me and you have talked about death quite a lot. We worked on two plays where your character died, but we haven't really talked about your mortality. I've realised that. What does the notion of your death mean to you, if anything at all?
Oh, it's so interesting because I grew up with a really, really, I think, healthy attitude to death, because my dad had lost both his parents very, very young under terribly tragic circumstances. And although he never talks about those specific incidents in any great detail, I spent a lot of my childhood in graveyards. They are comfortable places for me to be in. And it's funny because my eldest daughter has absolutely inherited that off me. Now, my husband and my youngest daughter can't stand it. They just find it the weirdest thing in the world, where me and Martha, we will happily wander around a graveyard looking at the different lives, really, really. So I don't know whether it gives us perspective or something, but I think it came from my childhood of always going, and my dad would always be like, this is where your grandma's buried, this is where your granddad's buried. There were no headstones ever. And the first thing practically I did when I got the job on Coronation Street all those years ago was to buy headstones and get them engraved as a surprise for my dad. Happy birthday.
Oh, that is so lovely.
But it's just like, it was something that was very much part of who we were. Also on top of that, he would always be telling me where he wanted his ashes spread, what hymns he wanted at his funeral. I mean, this is when I'm talking like 9, 10 years old. You know, this was part of my experience of being with my dad, him telling me about all his plans for those things. So I had it, you know, I had it down for when he actually did pass away. I absolutely knew what he wanted and was able to carry out those wishes, you know, to the letter. But all those things have given me a very healthy attitude towards it, I think. But in terms of my own mortality, I think I trick myself, like we often do, that I sometimes think about it. I've always felt like I'll live to be an old woman. I sort of see myself and imagine myself as an old woman, and I work to keep myself quite fit and healthy so that I can be active right to the end if I can. I mean, knowing all the time that nothing is permanent, that life can come and take your legs from under you at any point. Absolutely knowing that and living life to the full, because you don't know when it's going to go. It could be tomorrow. But it is a running joke in our house that I will outlive Kirsch by a country mile. You know, this absolutely, it would be the biggest shock to all of us if I went first.
Why is that?
Just genes and just health. He's falling to pieces. He's just like, and I'm just like, I come from a long line of very sturdy Lancashire women. I remember a really specific moment, and it was about 5 years ago, and it was in the morning, and I was in bed and I was lying under the covers, and I remember it hitting me the absolute total knowledge that one day I wouldn't be here. And it shocked me to the core. And I was just like, I won't be here. Where I am now, there will be nothing. Now, of course, that's not true, because I think that you live on in energy and, you know, what we call spirit, but actually means, you know, in the memories of other people and whatever. But yeah, that it was a real reality check. And I turned around to Kirsch and I told him, I said, I've just had this absolute sort of Damascus moments of like of my own mortality. And he said, yeah, welcome to my world. That's what I live with all the time. And all the times when I'm talking about death and dying with great abandon, he's just going, no, that's how I feel all the time. And whenever you talk about it, that's how I feel. That's why I don't ever want to talk about it. So it's and since then I realized that actually I'd been flirting around the edges of my own mortality properly, you know. And from the younger stage, because of my dad, I'd planned my funeral, I knew exactly what I wanted and everything. But it was another way, like you do, Raz, by talking about your lack of fear of death, of just going, of keeping it arm's length.
We have these defence mechanisms.
Yeah. And actually, you, Hannah, and Kirsch, I've been much more honest about that. For you to go into medicine, but with the full acknowledgement that death is something that scares you and that's something that unsettles you, but going into it with it, I mean, that's Buddhism right there. Do you know what I mean? That's like eyes wide open, going into something, going like, yeah, I'm afraid of it, but I will face it and I will do it, you know, and accept that it is absolutely a part of life.
Yeah, I suppose it is.
With Hannah, it goes even further, because Hannah has a fear of endings, full stop. Or no full stop, because that's an ending. but of endings, right?
Yeah, I have major endings issues, any kind of ending. End of a party, end of life, end of a relationship, end of a job. Yeah, I get so sad for the end, sad that it will never be like that ever again.
Hannah, I am exactly the same.
Are you?
I'm exactly the same. Yeah. I mean, it's a joke in our house that I would still be at nursery school if it was up to me. I have had to be dragged.
Exactly.
I've been dragged, kicking and screaming from every phase of my life into the others. It's like, but when I'm in the next phase, I'm totally in it from day one.
Me too. Like, I kick and scream and don't be the last to leave or, yeah, whatever. I don't want to move on. That's it. It's an explanation for why I'm always late as well, because I don't want to leave the previous thing. But, yeah, once I'm on the next thing, it's like, oh, my God, this is great.
Yeah, I'm totally the same. I mean, I was in Coronation Street for 16 years, and for me to leave that was nothing short of a miracle, because nobody was making me leave. Nobody said, right, you've got to go now. We're right in your character. It was my decision. And nobody could believe it.
Yeah.
Everybody at Corrie was like, but you said you'd stay forever. And I said, yeah, I did, didn't I? I know. And so I felt like that was the moment that I'd actually evolved as a human being, when I was able to make that choice. But subsequently, every job I've done, last night, weeping. I cry every job I leave. I can't bear it. And then the next morning I wake up and I'm like, oh, great, I don't have to work today. Lovely. And then I go on to the next one. I'm like, oh, what if this one's going to be harder? What if I don't like the people as much? What if I'm not as happy? And then I'm like, love it. Create my little community. Cry when I leave.
She always does say to me, oh, I'm worried that I won't be able to, I like being with you as a director, and I won't be able to, you know, be myself with this director. 2 days in, you know, he's like, oh, this is great. She's better than anyone I've ever worked with. It's like, oh, whatever. I'm dead to her now.
So, Raz, how is it, just because you're the one here who doesn't mind an ending, and we both do, and we've talked about how it is for us, how is it for you then with an ending? How do you deal with it so well?
I don't know if I deal with it well. I don't really think of endings, because I'm sort of blur one thing into another. It's even like the death thing. I think that maybe I do protest too much, probably. But at the same time, even when I was ill with cancer 25 years ago or in critical a year ago, it's not that I think I'm going to die or not, because I don't really think of it as an ending. It's sort of a blurring into what's happening next. And I think that's the same with lots of things with jobs. If I'm working with you, I'm really relieved it's ending. With other jobs, I don't see endings having sharp edges. I don't know. I don't really know what that means particularly, but it's something like that.
I think anyway, that makes complete sense, Raz, in terms of your obsession with legacy, because your death without legacy would be a sharp ending.
Yes.
And what you want is a blurring. So you want it to, you're happy, not happy, but you're accepting that it will have to end, but you're insistent that it will continue through some kind of legacy. And when you think about your mortality, you immediately think about how you can live on. As somebody who doesn't have kids in particular, you're just like, well, how do I avoid this sharp ending? Because I know you, and I know you do not like endings. You will do anything to blur an ending. For example, a relationship ending, you will always try and blur that into a friendship. And on the few occasions when it's looked like that's not been possible, it has caused you massive heartache, because you cannot stand that a person will just walk away and be absolutely not there if they've meant anything to you.
Note to editor Harry, please cut that bit out. I don't want anyone knowing what's... And that's very true.
True, Julie.
No, that is horribly true. But anyway, let's move on to the next elephant question.
So, Julie, what is your first memory of death? Like, do you remember when it first entered your consciousness? There a time, perhaps when you were younger, when you first realised it was a thing?
Yeah, well, as I say, you know, I grew up around it, in that my dad was always talking about it. And my mum, I think, had always been the opposite to my dad, in that she was always quite afraid of talking to me properly about death. So I remember being obsessed with old Hollywood stars. So saying like, is Judy Garland still alive? And my mum being like, no. And me being heartbroken and said, how did she die? And my mum would say, her heart stopped beating. And that was always her answer for everything.
On the toilet.
But that is genuinely my most vivid memory.
That is so cute.
But the Elvis's death is an absolute key moment in my relationship with death. Colwyn Bay, 1977. but standing in this little bed and breakfast bedroom, and my mum came to me and said, Elvis has died, Jew. Elvis has died. And us both weeping with our arms around each other in this little B&B in Colwyn Bay. Yeah. So probably that, actually.
Oh, gorgeous.
That's the most amazing image I've ever seen in my life. I mean, that's a movie. Kirsch, if you're listening, if you're not listening, Kirsch, why not? If you are listening, write that movie. So moving it on to sort of those moments in our lives, I don't think of you as someone who has many regrets and stuff. You seem to own the choices you've made. And to... I wondered if there's been any significant sliding doors moments where, you know, you chose that fork and not that fork, and what would have happened if I chose a different one?
Yeah, I do have regrets. I do have a lot of regrets in my life, but those regrets have been about behaviour, about things that I've done that have hurt other people, and things that I am genuinely haunted by, you know, the ways that I've wronged people in the past. And but in terms of choices made, in terms of the big picture of the sort of roadmap of my life, if you like, I'm absolutely accepting the choices I've made have led me to where I am, and where I am feels like a good place. So I feel very, very lucky in that respect. I mean, and right from, you know, just the accident of birth, of growing up where I did and when I did. You know, I wasn't born into economic advantage, but I was born into huge state advantage, you know, and the state changed. So I know that what won't happen is that one day we'll wake up and it'll be on the front page of the paper, the NHS is over. I know that won't happen. I know it'll be incremental. I know how the state dismantles a system that benefits everybody. My absolute fuel in life now is keeping my eye on that, because I took my eye off the ball in my 20s and 30s and I let too many things go. So I'm front of the queue now in trying to fight those things.
I mean, if you're talking sliding doors, that's all that sliding doors is. You do the thing you do, and like you say, the course of history will change itself. However small or big those things are, you know, that adds, like you say, incrementally to the things that you want change. You're not going to just make the change, but, you know, without them, the incrementals don't have it, because you can't add one and one if one and one don't exist.
Yeah, so you do your little bit every day.
Yeah. And in terms of sliding doors as well, I think that I just go, you know, in terms of things that happen, you know, sometimes you really want to do a job and it doesn't happen for some reason, or something doesn't go the way that you have hoped it would. I think I'm pretty good, or have been all right so far, at going, well, that's just not meant to be. Do you know what I mean? Just to kind of like being quite accepting of that, of like, this is the map of my life.
Yeah, it's your Buddhist.
Maybe.
Penchant.
You genuinely are my teacher at that.
Oh, I'm enjoying that. Say that again, Mas. Say it again.
Oh, no. Yeah, cut that out. No, but, you know, there's one big moment in the last couple of years where we went to a big job together and it didn't work out, and I was more gutted than I thought I would be, and I think you were pretty gutted at the time too, obviously, but you found a way for me to make it like that's, and I'm not, certainly in no way am I as spiritual as you, but to make it like that was the universe telling us that that's not the right thing for us right now. The universe was telling us, you know, for that job, it's their time, not ours. And our time is something different. And that's you who taught me that.
Keep learning, students.
Right. Enough of this nice shit. Get on to another death question quick, Hannah.
Julie, have you had any brushes with death yourself?
Well, again, do you know, I feel like sometimes you don't really realise at the time. You know, we're driving down the M1 once, the three of us, me, Kirsch and Martha, before Liz was with us, and the wheel came off on the M1, and I was in the inside lane, and there was, for many, many months afterwards, on this grass verge at the side of the motorway where the sort of like tyre tracks where I'd come off the road. And it was this tiny bit of soft verge. The rest of it had been just like walls and barriers. And I don't think we would have survived it in this little tin can camper van that we had. Kirsch was in the back without any wow. seat belts, just on this sort of, you know, bank. And it was just like, it was just almost like, oh, I'll just pull off. Yeah, and like teetered on the edge of this verge. And afterwards, when we drive down, we were like, wow, that was a really good place to lose the wheel, you know. So I feel so lucky, you know. That could have been a completely different story.
The universe wanted you to live that day.
It's like, I mean, honestly, I think you've got to be really, really careful in not thinking. I mean, my family is full of that kind of mythology, and it is self-mythologizing. It's like, yes, I still had work here to do. I had Raz to teach about, you know, acceptance of things moving forward. You know, it's like obviously the universe didn't choose me to live. But I have been very, very lucky, you know.
But I guess, the dice fell in your favour for whatever reason on that day. Yeah.
And it's interesting, the kind of close shaves and thinking about the what ifs, because like in The Greatest Play, your character, who we know, Hannah, Julie and I have constant discussion, for all the people who haven't seen it, we won't spoil it, but we have a constant discussion about who the character is. Anyway, whoever the character is in the play talks about cramming it all in. That cramming every bit of life you can in. And you know, as Hannah said, and we've talked about, you do have more energy than the world, and you sort of very rarely get tired, which is the most annoying thing in the world, especially when you're my housemate for 6 weeks and you're up at 7 with your 2 glasses of tea and I'm just doing my pages and my yoga and I'll be with you at 8:30. I'm not even up at 8:30. Go away. Anyway, I mean, my question...
You are painting me out to be such a wanker. I can't bear it.
You are a total wanker, but a really great one. But here's a really wanky question. Are you aware of the clock of life ticking?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm 51 and I had a big 50th last year.
Yeah, you had 300, wasn't it like 300 closest friends at your 50th? Something like that.
At least. I've just made a little documentary with Radio 4 about red letter days and about the way we mark these big birthdays and these big events in our life and why we feel the compulsion to do that. You know, why we don't really go with the more natural ebbs and flows of life, like, you know, menopause, you know, oh, right, yeah, I'm definitely menopausal now, no period for a whole year, let's have a party. It's always just like these guys.
This is great.
Yeah, these quite arbitrary numbers, you know, it's just like, oh, it's a decade, and what does that mean? And 50 in particular, you know, it feels sort of like a very round, big fat round number. And so naturally, I think when you hit those big figures, you do start to think about, you know, where you've come from, how much time you've got left. I find myself obsessing about things that seem in quite recent memory. Like I'll think sort of 30 years ago this year, I left drama school. And that, you know, I can remember it really, really clearly. I was an adult. I had a lot of the same friends as I have now. And so it doesn't feel that long ago. I mean, I was probably a very different person, but 30 years. And then I think, oh, so in 30 years in the future, I'll be 81. And that's like really, really shocking to me. You know, it's like, wow. So in this same like blink of an eye, I will be, you know, if the fates allow, 81. And that's just like, wow, it really is a very, very short time that we're here. And that is, it is quite sobering sometimes to think about that. And I don't worry about it. I don't think, I am quite accepting of it. I think that comes and goes though. I think sometimes you just think, wow.
But
you know,
does it drive you?
No, I don't think it does drive me. I don't think it does drive me. I think because I feel like I'm at a place where a lot of the things that I've wanted to do, I've done, you know, and that's, again, a massive privilege, you know. And sometimes when you think about personal ambition, you think, what is that about? You know, where do you want to get to? You know, sometimes you see someone win an Oscar and you think, what now? Now you've got to win another Oscar. And you've got, you know, it's like you're just kind of like, what is this sort of like treadmill that you're on of trying to grasp some kind of idea of success? And when you're living at your best and your fullest and your richest is when you are in the now. You know, and again, I know that this is like, I really have turned into like a proper Buddhist nun, haven't I? But it's, I do think that that's when you're at your best, when you can just be like, okay, here I am. I've got a bunch of daffodils on my window that are just opening. That's nice. Another year, daff time, always coincides with my birthday. Nice. You know, I've, everyone's well. That's okay. We've got through the pandemic. We've kept both our mums here. You know, we've kept them safe. That's good. That's an achievement. And, you know, doing these little bits of jobs that are quite fulfilling and interesting to me that are keeping me sort of creatively alive. And that's my best. And sometimes the culture can sort of encroach on that and make me go, oh, I should be doing something else. I should be, God, I'm not working enough in London. I'm so regional, you know, maybe it's knowing that that stuff is just bollocks, you know, and that stuff is the product of our society that's just telling us all the time that we have to be better and, you know, more successful than we are, and that's when you go into a dangerous territory. I think, is it the same in medicine, Hannah? Is there, because my brother's an academic and I know he feels it, you know, he's got to have a certain amount of books out, he's got to have a certain amount of stuff. Is it?
I think I was thinking this when I was reading your book, like I think it's universal actually, where we're all sort of programmed to be doing whatever we're doing but kind of constantly striving for something that we're not, you know, we're not quite there yet. Just like you say, rather than standing there and going, actually, I am so lucky. Things are really good. The people I love are safe. We're constantly thinking, oh, I haven't done that yet. I should be doing that. Look at what all these people are doing. I think that's a lesson that's so important for us all to learn. The thing about in one of the things you said in your book, actually, sorry, I sound a bit wanky now, about how, you know, stop concentrating on the consumption of what you're doing and focus on the making and the creating. And that really does center you and bring you back, and stop that kind of anxiety and that voice in your head. And I think that is such an important lesson to learn.
I think I'm in the presence of two gurus here. I think I'm now mesmerized into, I know the path to righteousness, and they're called Hannah and Julie. Ladies
it's
and gentlemen.
It's not terrible. It's just like, okay, she'll have a funny story or two. And then it's like, yeah, I just think it's all about impermanence.
Oh, it's great. I love it. I'm still mesmerized.
How did we get down this wormhole? Right. We've shut Raz up. I mean, this is a success in itself.
We can die up, you know.
It's kind of extraordinary.
High five. Okay, next question actually follows on very nicely from all that wankiness, which is, Julie, what do you think your 21-year-old self would think of your 51-year-old self?
Oh, I love this question.
And what advice, this is one of Raz's faves, what advice would you give your 21-year-old self now?
I think these questions are always really hard to answer without sort of, without going into like a world of trope pain, in it, because, you know, there's always things that it's like, oh, I wish I could have known this, and I wish I could have accepted myself as I was. And I just think that the mess that you are when you're 21 is just a necessary part of the hopefully slightly less messy person that you are at 51. You know, it's all part of it. So I wouldn't really want to tell her anything apart from just like, oh, it'll be okay, you know. And for me, the pursuit of love was a big preoccupation for me in, you know, that part of my life, you know, and the fear that it would elude me, you know. And it hasn't, you know, and again, I'm so grateful for that. And that is the thing that it's the basis for all this wankiness that only comes because I can be in this safe place to be whatever kind of wanker I want to be today. You know, it's like, and I think that That is what I would want to reassure 21-year-old Jew, is that, you know, you will be loved and you will have good relationships and that will be possible for you and you'll get there. You'll get there.
Oh, that's nice. Give her a big hug.
Yeah.
Yeah, give her a hug from me. Tell her, say no to that Raz when he forces you to do that play and then he didn't have to put up with her living in his house for 6 weeks. Tell her that.
I'll pass it on.
Leads us to the kind of, these sort of last few questions are the sort of point of the podcast, but also I think are the hardest. But we want to ask them anyway. I guess the first one being, what's been your greatest achievements up to this point?
I suppose my good relationships. I feel like I have good relationships. Somebody said this to me recently. I got a lovely sort of supportive text from my brother about a tricky day I'd had on a job recently. And I was in the back of a car with another actor. And I read this text out. And she said, oh my God, you have such good relationships. And honestly, I've never been as chuffed to hear anything in my life, you know. And the way she articulated it, I was like, and I thought, yeah, I do. I have good relationships. I have good relationships with my family and my friends, you know, and I haven't always, because I was, you know, I have been an arsehole in my life, you know, and drunk too much and behaved badly and done things I regret. And I just feel like, and I still do, I still get things desperately wrong, but I feel like I've got good communication with the people that I care about and love, and I value that. I really, really do value that. That, and I got to know in my stomach when I've got something wrong, and I hope I'm never too proud to sort of come clean about that and apologise for it. And so, yeah, so good relationships will be the first one. And I suppose the other thing is something quite new, which is this little organisation that I set up. And it's an idea that I completely nicked off somebody else, called 500 Acts of Kindness. And I'm so proud of what it does, because it's such a simple thing. So Joe Sims, an actor who was in Broadchurch with me, he set up this thing in the first place. And it's like 500 people give a quid a week, and then they're free to nominate a family, an individual or an organisation who might need 500 quid that week. And then they just give it to them. No questions asked, really. And I was part of this group for a while. I still am part of it. And I kept nominating, and Joe got a bit annoyed, I think, and said, why don't you set up your own? And so I did. I don't know how many people we've got now, but it's like nearer 1,000, I think. You know, and then a lot of our members like work at the coal face, are like, you know, housing and benefits and energy, you know, debt and stuff. And so they can bring people to us who are really, you know, really in desperate situations and say, you know, this person has fallen behind with council tax, they've ended up with this huge debt, they're going to be evicted, they're in a terrible way, 500 quid will give them some breathing space. And we go, okay, give us their account details, and we transfer it straight away, £500 into their account.
That is amazing.
People are so used to having to be put through the mill to get the most basic help in our country now. You know, it's like become the most...
Forms and more forms. And
you know, what you deserve. What do you deserve? Are you deserving of this? Yeah. And it's just like, we just go, no, we trust you. Here you are. Here's £500. You can make a little sensory garden for your, you know, neurodiverse child. You can pay off that... you know, that heating bill. You can buy a new laptop, you know, so you can start your career. You can mend that bit of fence so you can start your dog walking business. You know, we've paid for funerals, you know, we've paid for so many funerals because they're so unbelievably expensive, even at the most basic level. And if someone hasn't got, you know, we've got, you know, children left behind by parents who've died who just have no way of, like, seeing their parents off in any way. So... and I just love it. I love the casualness of it, and I love the way that we can just do it. I mean, we've given over £10,000 away since the beginning of this year, you know. I mean, it's huge amounts of money that we give away, but actually, it's a pound.
It speaks to how to you as a person, but also speaks to your energy, because I'm always amazed when I see it come through that you're still doing it every week alongside all those other things, because it's not a small thing.
Well, it is much easier than it looks. And me and Chris always laugh and think we'd get so much credit for it. But the running of it is an absolute joy, and it is absolute minimum work for the most maximum sort of like soul feeding you can get, because we're let me get this clear. You know, it is a sticking plaster over a gaping wound that is the need that people are living through right now, you know, and it is huge, and especially during the pandemic. You know, we're not under any illusions that we're changing things, but we know, you know, in that Emerson quote of like, if you can help one person breathe more easily, that's part of that quote too, that this is to have succeeded. I know that every week we help at least a couple of people breathe a little bit more easily for that week. It's the kindness of that community that is almost as important to the people who are receiving it as the money is, you know. And I really, really love it. And I think that if I never did anything else, if, you know, now for the rest of my life, I would absolutely have that as you know, something that I've managed to achieve even though I nicked it off somebody else. It's just like that I know that it's doing something.
Yeah, it's an incredible achievement. And brings me on to another question, actually, which is, what do you feel that you have anything left to achieve? And if so, what?
Well, again, I suppose it's like what we were talking about earlier, isn't it? I try not to get too driven by that. You know, people, always, when you're an actor, people are always asking you like, well, what what role have you always wanted to play? You know, and I've never been like that. I've never been like, I'll never get to give my Juliet or whatever. You know, it's like.
Well, you still might.
Yeah, you never know these days. But I think that for me, the jobs that I want, I don't exist yet, because I love new writing and I love new ideas and I love being in a rehearsal room with a group of other people and making stuff together. You know, I have a little theatre company in Manchester called Take Back, as you know, Hannah, from my book, and you know, we're making stuff. And you know, at the moment we're planning something about sex work, because what we're interested in is the sort of areas where people say on the left, the liberal left, are still disagreeing, you know. So there's like, it's a thorny issue, is the issue of decriminalisation of sex work. And we want to try and make a piece about that that's immersive, that puts all the arguments across and that starts big conversations about that. So I'm working on that at the moment. So I'm reading some really interesting sex worker-led stuff about that. And that excites me, you know. So it's like, that's the next thing. That's the next thing I want to achieve, is to put that on. Take Greatest Player on the road again and do that.
I guess you don't know what else you've got left to achieve, especially when someone's as busy as you are. You don't know what's going to come up.
Well, yeah, and it was really, really important to say, because I get a lot, and I think the working diary did a lot to help this sort of myth about me that I'm always busy. I mean, there's nothing like having to write a diary about your working life to like make you go out and do something that day when you maybe can't be arsed. You know, it's not completely truthful like way of looking. I mean, I do manage to watch an excessive amount of trash TV as well. You know, it's not like I live this life. I don't wake up in the morning, do my yoga, do my pages, like go out for a run and then go like, right, what can I achieve to make the world better today? You know, there's a lot of like Married at First Sight Australia series 6, you know, that's taken over my life. You know, there's plenty of that too.
Let's not start that. We could be here for hours.
Yeah, you and Raz could do a whole other podcast about that.
Oh my goodness.
And so, Julie, how do you want to be remembered?
Or do you want to be remembered?
Of course I do. I mean, you know, I'd be lying if I said that I don't think about legacy. And I mean, in this documentary I've been making about 50th birthdays, I interviewed Lem Cissé, and he was just like, oh, legacy, we don't do things for legacy. You know, we don't go around going like, oh, what legacy am I leaving? I'm like, well, I do. But I just think, I try not to think about that. And honestly, at the end of it all, if my two daughters, if I can be remembered by them and they can talk about me with the fondness that my dad talks about his Auntie Ida, you know, to their children, I think that would be absolutely enough for me. I don't need anything beyond that. I mean, I know my legacy is that I played Hayley in Coronation Street, and I'm very proud of that legacy. I've always said that my obituary picture will be me in that bloody red anorak and wig with my pineapple juice in Rovers, no matter what I achieve. I could be first woman on Mars and they'll still print that picture of me as Hayley. So I've had to make peace with that a long time ago. So, you know, so legacy has been ticked off by the culture we live in. And I'll get on with just trying to be like the best mum I can be for now.
Yeah. Oh, amazing.
That leads us inexorably to your death. And I've waited to say that for a long time. and I guess, again, as I said when we're talking with Ish, you know, when I was ill 25 years ago with cancer, and I was a boy who was a man boy at 28 and hadn't really done much in his life and wanted to get into the theatre, but hadn't done anything, and talking about legacy, you sit there thinking you're going to die and thinking what you're going to be remembered for. And so in order to have at least one theatrical moment in my life, I wrote my memorial service. And sadly, it's on some old computer somewhere and I can't find it, which I'm sort of gutted about. So this is sort of, again, part of the point of this podcast is what you think your memorial service will be like, what songs and readings might be in it, and is there anything else apart from songs and readings that you'd want in it that would really represent the essence of Jew? That's like a new Jo Malone candle. It's called The Essence of Jew.
Oh, you might be onto something there, Al. First of all, I am astonished that you, as the archivist of your own life, lost that document with your memorial service on it. I'm absolutely,
I know,
dumbfounded that that has happened to you. Yeah, I spent a lot of earlier years obsessing about that. Again, as a product of my dad constantly telling me what he wanted at his funeral, and down to the hymns and everything. So I spent a lot of time writing those instructions down over my life. And what I've realised recently is that it's not up to you. You're not going to be there. It's what's helpful to the people who are left behind. And I really, really, truly believe that now. Because it's just like, it's the final act of letting go, of not controlling everything, is just going, you know, my friend Brian, when he passed away last year, hadn't left any instructions and he hadn't left any wishes. And he was constantly talking about his own mortality and everything that he had to do before he finally passed away. And he died very suddenly. And there was nothing. And we were all a bit shocked. We thought that he'd have wishes written down and an idea of, you know, the work that he might want us to continue to do. And his funeral, which was a Facebook Live funeral, which he would have absolutely loved because it was right at the top of the pandemic. So there were only a very, very few people able to go, was very simple and had a lot of words from people who cared about him, which, you know, matters a lot, I think. But in terms of the choices of the funeral and the religion of the funeral and everything, that was down to his daughter because she was the person who needed it to serve her. You know, and I think that's right. I think that's right. I think that you've got to stop trying to control things even beyond your death and say, you know, whatever will help you get through that day, that you just, you know, just fill your boots.
Oh, wow. Don't give me the power.
I would love you to be in charge of that. I think you'd do a lovely job, Roz.
My mind is racing at the moment about how offensive I could possibly be.
Hard hats at the ready over here.
You're not going to be there.
What? No, I really am not going to be there. No, that is true. But unfortunately, we set a precedent in the last podcast whereby we ended with a thing that Ish was going to have, you know. And so I've got to press you if you were from beyond the grave, going to have one thing, I'm pressing you so that we can put it at the end of this podcast. If you were going to have one thing, be it a reading or a song or something, come on.
Yeah. Well, what I'm going to do is I am going to predict what my family would do.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
And I think that they would have the final speech from Greatest Play in the History of the World, which is all about what you would choose to leave behind. If you had one image or sound or feeling that you would want to put on the golden record and be sent into the outer solar system just in case extraterrestrial life would find it, what would that be?
Oh, it's so gorgeous, that speech. I remember it so well.
It's amazing. And you know, and it's written by Kirsch for me, directed by Raz. What more could I ask for? You know, and it's a play that's really become like very central to us as a family, and especially now in the pandemic, taking it out on the road again, a play being as it is all about isolation and loneliness and connection and lost love, it's just perfect. So I can't imagine that Martha wouldn't think to go like, let's dig out the dusty old copy of Dad's play and do that.
Dad's old play.
And I'm absolutely positive that the song that they would send me off to would be S Club's Reach. because that has been our family song forever. We go on holiday to this beautiful place in West Wales every single summer. And as we approach it, we put Reach on the stereo and we sing it. And it is the anthem of the Hesmond Hells Career Shows. And I would be shocked if that wasn't some part of the final goodbye.
What a great song. Love it.
It is brilliant. I could pick things that
Hannah,
are cooler.
Get researching the rights quick.
I'm on it.
That's amazing. And actually, the Hesmond Hells Kershaw, I think it could rival the Osbournes. You know, Netflix came and made that series.
It would be very boring indeed.
I mean, this has just been, we've had a very nice time. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Julie.
Thank you, Hannah.
You've been so brilliant.
No, it's been so lovely to talk to you. I felt like it was a good discussion, don't you?
Definitely. Do I press stop now, Hannah?
We don't want the ending, so we're just going to carry on all afternoon, if that's okay.
Absolutely. Can you see how I'm trying to stop us from ending? You know, I'm actually pissing my pants. Go on.
I'm starving, but yeah, let's just keep talking.
What is it that you would want to be preserved for eternity? A photograph of the tip of Everest? An Indian spice market? Or the view from a bar overlooking the ocean in Big Sur, California? The taste of a tear? Of blood? Of sweat? The sound of the rustle of a daffodil as it blooms? The smell of coarse salt and sharp vinegar on seaside fish and chips? That moment when someone notices you for being you and gets it, they get you, that feeling, that. The touch and grab and snap of clenched skin, muscle and flesh in that moment of complete and utter hunger-sating ecstasy. The feel of your mother's hand walking you to your first day at school, or the hand held in yours of the first person you fell in love with. Or the last handhold of the person you've loved most in your whole life. The last handhold of that person who loved you right back.
You've been listening to Death and the Elephant, an Elephant production produced and edited by Harry Winteringham. Music composed and arranged by Mark Melville and featuring Dr. Hannah Harris and Raz Shaw. Reach was composed by Kathy Dennis. The extract from The Greatest Play in the History of the World by Ian Kershaw was read by Martha Kershaw. You can catch The Greatest Play on tour, opening at the Stephen Joseph Theatre on the 18th of May, and subsequently at the Chester Storyhouse, the York Theatre, Holtrop Theatre, Nottingham Playhouse and Liverpool Playhouse. All details can be found at tarafinney.com.